Bill Still is a former newspaper editor and publisher, best-selling author, and award-winning documentary writer-director. He's written for USA Today, the Saturday Evening Post, the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, Omni Magazine, and produced a syndicated radio program, Health News. He's written 20 books, including his latest, No More National Debt, and three feature-length documentaries, including The Money Masters, which is the 15th most-watched film on the Internet, and The Secret of Oz, winner of the Best Documentary of 2010. Hello, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Bill, I know that you classify yourself as a reporter and not as a financial expert, but I'd like to say thanks to you because many of us understand the U.S. financial system and the Federal Reserve Bank much better. Would you please give my listeners a short history of the Federal Reserve Bank and its forerunners?
You just said a mouthful there.
Well, just a short history.
Well, I mean, the whole point behind this discussion is if you go out on the street and ask the average person how money is created in this country or who creates money in this country, the average person will kind of scratch their head, and if they'll think it's a trick question, but ultimately what they'll say is the government creates the money. And the reason they say that is because they intuitively know that it is the most important power of government is to create and control its own money. That's not the situation we have today, and that is the problem. I don't care how you get there, but what we have to do is get back to a system where money is created in the public interest. That's not what's going on today. What's going on today is money is created and the quantity is controlled by the biggest banks, and thereby they control the political situation as well. And thus it has ever been, time and time again throughout history in every different nation, when the banking class gains control of the quantity of the national money, they also gain control of the political situation, and thereby they get the government to start borrowing money from them, and that only increases their control, according to the Bible, the borrower will be servant to the lender. This goes on and on until the civilization collapses and is reconstituted. Now, what the problem is we have today, is that we've never had before, is we have this situation that's gone on in every nation in the world, basically since the turn of the last century. The Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, so it's been going on here in the United States for about 100 years. And this time, the nations are working together to try to maintain monetary control and thereby political control. And that's why we see, for the first time in history, when nations create extra money, i.e. stimulus, it no longer increases their GDP. So what we've run up into is, for the first time in history, a situation called debt saturation, where these debt money systems are now completely saturate society. This is a long way of getting around to answering your question, but I think it's interesting to give the very broad perspective of how this came about. Back about 3,000 years ago in Sumeria, it was always the same situation. When the lending class was able to get their tentacles into government and lend the government money, then they ended up controlling the political situation as well. It's called, political science has a name for this, it's called plutocracy. It's something that we have right now that we don't want. We want to get back to government by we the people. We want to get back to deconsolidating power, whereas today we have ever-increasing levels of consolidation of power. But in any case, the Sumerians came up with with the concept of the Jubilee, because they knew that society would collapse from these debts about every 50 years. And so that's why you see in the Bible the concept of the biblical Jubilee, where every 50 years all the debts were forgiven. Well, this preceded the Bible. It went way back into Samaria. They're the ones that came up with it. Well, of course, that cycle of the Jubilee has been broken now, and we've been in this completely controlled debt money system since the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, so it's been about 100 years, about twice as long they've been able to keep this Ponzi scheme going. So it's good and due for a collapse. So that's the overlying structure that we're talking about here.
Well, we pay for every dollar printed, I understand. Would you know what percentage the Federal Reserve Bank gets on every dollar it prints?
Oh, that's not even a question. The Fed doesn't make money off of this. They send all of their profits back to the Treasury. See, this kind of speaks to the whole misnomer that Ron Paul perpetuates, that ending the Fed is going to do anything. It won't. When I first made the Money Masters, the first cut of the edit, I decided I wanted to send to a professor of economics. So I said, well, I'm going to shoot for the moon. I'm going to try to get Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize-winning economist, certainly the most famous economist of the past century. And so, you know, being a reporter, I knew how to get in touch with professors. You call the university press office and say, hey, I've got this documentary. I'd like Milton Friedman to take a look at it. And sure enough, a couple hours later, ring, ring, Milton Friedman's on the phone. And he's very gracious, and he says, yeah, sure, send it to me, overnight it to me, I'll look at it over the weekend. So Monday came, and ring, ring, Milton Friedman on the phone again. And I never forget the first thing he said to me. He said, boy, if you end the Fed and you don't do anything about fractional reserve lending, you've done nothing. And that was a shocker, but he was right. He, of course, understood it a lot better than I did. And so we had to rejigger the whole Money Masters to take into account this fact. In other words, I'd fallen for the same thing that now Ron Paul is falling for, and that is that the problem is the Fed. The problem is not the Fed. To use the Wizard of Oz analogy, the Fed is just like the curtain in the Wizard of Oz, the curtain that hides the wizard. It's not the Fed. It's the wizard behind the curtain, and the wizard behind the curtain is the big banks behind the Fed. The Fed is just there to make it look like some part of the government is controlling the big banks. When you and I know, when we think about it, that the Fed isn't controlling the banks. The banks are controlling the Fed. It's the other way around. So if we don't do anything about the basic root problem, and that is that the banks are creating all of our money, every dollar in circulation, as an interest-bearing debt, we cannot possibly get close to solving this problem.
Well, I saw something the other day, and I don't know if it's true or not. Maybe you can help me with this. I saw something that said that we owe these big banks more money than we owe China and Japan put together. Have you ever
heard that? Well, I guess that's true if you count in, because the national debt is, what, $14.4 trillion at this point, and, a substantial portion we owe with China, but it's certainly less than a trillion. So all of the national debt is our national money, so that there just happens to be almost exactly the amount of debt, $14.4 trillion, as there is the amount of money in the system, about $14.5 trillion. So all of our money is the national debt. That's why it's laughable when you see these politicians get on TV and say, oh, if we just cut back on our spending, we can start to pay down the national debt. That is absolutely an impossibility. We cannot pay down the national debt. To reduce the debt would be to reduce our money. Can you imagine reducing the amount of money, the economic climate? It would be an absolute disaster. So what we have to do is get out of the box, get out of this debt money system. You don't want to reduce the national debt. You want to eliminate it entirely, eliminate the system that created it, eliminate the ability of the government to borrow. It sounds overwhelming, but it's really not. It's really simple. Here's the prescription for fixing this. I'll tell you right up front, and then we can talk about it. Number one, you eliminate the ability of the government to borrow. This borrowing is what drives over government spending. If government had to raise taxes to create a new spending program, then they wouldn't create new spending programs. You have to eliminate the ability of the federal government to borrow. This was Jefferson's only complaint about the Constitution, and it's so true today. That's why I entitled my new book, No More National Debt, because we don't have to live in a national debt system. It's really simple to fix. This problem is not difficult. It's right before our eyes. And then the second thing you've got to do is eliminate the control by the big banks. And the way you do that is just make it so that banks can only lend money they actually have. Right now, banks are supposed to be constrained to only lending out 12 times the amount of money they actually have, when in fact, I think I heard an economist from MIT yesterday saying that the average European bank, for example, and the American banks are going to be about the same, are leveraged 33-1 right now. In other words, they only hold $3 for every $100 that they're lending out.
Well, I'd just like to interrupt you 1 second, if I may. We're talking about the fractional reserve here, right? The reason I mention this is so my listeners understand what's going on.
Right. There are two great pillars upon which monetary reform, which is what we need to do, rest. Number one, no more national debt, no more government borrowing. And number two, ending fractional reserve lending. That is, banks can only, under the new system, can only lend money they actually have. In other words, they don't get the counterfeit money to lend out any more than you or I would be able to do.
And would you explain what fiat money is?
Well, that's a misnomer, too. The gold bugs, those who favor a return to a gold money, try to use the term fiat as meaning some bad form of paper money not backed by gold or silver coin, when in fact what the term really means in its original understanding is any money declared to be money by the government. So, in other words, all the gold coins of the 1920s and early 1930s before Roosevelt called them in, they were all legal tender, and therefore, by definition, they were fiat money as well. So the gold bugs hate to hear that sad truth, but it is the...
It seems that we get no benefit at all from the way the Federal Reserve Bank runs, but... Is there something I'm missing? Is there any benefit to having this system at all?
No, absolutely none. It's just centralized control of our money in the hands of the biggest banks. They create most of the money. We're not talking about the smaller community banks. The problem is in the bigger banks, which are gobbling up the smaller community banks at a frightening rate now. The Federal Reserve System, and it's not really a bank, it's a system. The design is to control the big banks and their lending practices, but in fact, as I said before, they don't control it at all. The banks are, the Fed is just a diversion to make us think that there's some sort of control.
Most people believe that the Revolutionary War was fought because we didn't want to pay taxes to the British. Would you please explain how we were supposed to pay these taxes and why it led to war?
Well, the problem was that America was basically built on paper money, not on gold and silver money, because there was not very much, you know, this was basically a wilderness country in the early stages, and there wasn't much gold or silver in the country. So we had to experiment with printing our own homegrown paper money. And of course, paper money works just fine, except for one thing, and that's when you print too much of it. So back in the colonial days, all the different states were chartering their own individual state banks, and nobody knew exactly how much money one bank was issuing or another bank was issuing. So it was difficult to do commerce across state lines. So when the continental currency came in, the continental currency worked great until during the Revolutionary War, the British started counterfeiting it, and of course that that vastly increased the quantity and wiped out the quality of the money. But to go back a little bit, the British actually, before the war, forbid the colonies from printing their own paper money, forced them to pay their taxes in only gold coin. Well, there wasn't much gold coin around, and so to drastically change the money system like that, it led, as it always does, to a huge depression. And the colonists knew exactly what was going on. Britain had took away the ability of the colonies to create their own money. And so that's what they are mad about. And according to Benjamin Franklin, this was the root cause of the American Revolution. So I think maybe that answers your question.
Right. Another thing I was interested in is how in the world did these bankers convince European nations to attack us in 1812?
Well, they wanted to split the country. They knew that America was getting out of control, and America may well, you know, start printing their own paper money again. The American economic engine had fired up, and the British and the other Europeans wanted to put basically the banking class of those nations wanted to try to put a stop to this, and so. We had a series of privately owned central banks in the early days. The first one was called the Bank of North America. It was chartered in the 1780s, I believe, and immediately started lending money to the government. This immediately caused massive inflation, and so a couple Congresses later, 4 years later, Congress voted them out. Then, you know, but the European central bankers were not done. A few years later, they managed to finance enough congressional candidates to get enough votes to vote their bank back in. And so they put back in the first bank of the United States, and it started lending money to the government, and it started causing inflation. And the bankers had the foresight to make the bank have a 20-year charter. And so when that charter came due in 1816, it looked like the Congress was going to vote it out, and so there were reports that threatening war if the First Bank of the United States was voted out by Congress. Congress voted it out, and sure enough, the British invaded Washington and burned it, and that was the War of 1812. And so the bankers didn't give up, and in fact, that was the root cause of the American Civil War as well. So they've always tried to control the vast riches and energies of the freedom-loving American people, and this is kind of like a beneath-the-surface war on the financial front that's gone on throughout American history. And right now, they've had their way for about 100 years, and now their system is going to implode, crash and burn from its own weight of massive debt. And the bankers don't know exactly how to deal with this. And the way we are going to deal with this eventually is we're going to implement the system that I've been talking about, and that's no more national debt and banks only and no more fractional reserve lending.
You know, it's hard to believe, though, that these banks could corrupt so many people in Europe as to get them to do their bidding, because they had to corrupt almost everybody in the government, I would think, in order to get them to raise the troops to send over here. It's a massive undertaking, isn't it?
No, it's not really, because the banking system is essentially the same over there. You have a privately owned central banks, and they funnel money to legislative candidates, and so you know, it takes a very bold parliamentarian to go against the banking powers. When he knows, you know, then they're going to go against him, and they have virtually unlimited money. So it doesn't really take so much overt control. It's just they know who has the money.
Right. How many presidents have tried to stop the central bank in the United States, and what happened when they tried this?
Well, a lot of them have, and a lot of them have faced assassination attempts or assassination. Andrew Jackson was probably the first one. He ran the entire 8 years of his two terms as president, he fought against the central bank, privately owned central bank of his era, which is called the Second Bank of the United States. And he finally killed it towards the end of his presidency. And as soon as he had killed it, an assassin got right up to him, put two pistols in his stomach. They were flintlock pistols. And he fired both pistols, and they both misfired. And so Jackson was spared. Then, of course, Lincoln defied the bankers. The bankers wanted to charge him 36% interest to pursue the war. And when you're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, 36% is just outrageous, an unbelievable burden on the government. So Lincoln decided, Lincoln fortunately had an old economist in his cabinet, his chief economist, I forget the gentleman's name, but it's in the book, who was familiar with the Jacksonian era, and so he suggested that you just print government-issued money, not backed by gold or silver. You print just enough of it to pursue the war, and then once the war is over, you tax any excess out of existence, and you just watch inflation, and as long, you know, you take back just enough money by taxation to keep inflation at zero, and then, you know, it works perfectly well. Well, the bankers weren't going to put up with that, so they helped finance the Confederacy, and they were prepared to split America in half, keep it perpetually in war, North versus South, to try to keep it weakened so that they could keep it controlled.
Now, the IMF, or International Monetary Fund, it's hated by a lot of countries, where it's tried to force not only loans on them, but also dictate how the country should be run. Do you think that this is an attempt to take over a country and destroy democracy?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And the poorer the nation, the more horrible the influence of the IMF, because they go in there and they promise the current ruler, loans if he'll just indebt the nation, and then the next guy has to pay the interest and everything, and so it keeps the nation very poor, completely subservient to the IMF. The IMF is just, you know, a further consolidation of the banking powers on the world level, and this is to be opposed. I favor deconsolidation of power at every level of governance. I mean, there's not a single level of government anywhere in the world that has too little power. They all have too much power, and we should always go for deconsolidation of power.
Well, your videos appear in a lot of places. Do you think that more people are recognizing the fact that we are really being taken advantage of by private banks?
Well, yeah, that too. But I think there's something even more basic, and that is that people see that, the current system's not working. It's not working for them. It's not working for any nation. How can it be, you know, for the first time in history, you know, usually it's one nation has a bad time while the other nation has a good time, but at this point in history, every nation is in trouble, even China. There's great talk about unrest in China because they've got so much money pouring into the system right now that inflation is killing them. I mean, China's annualized inflation rate is over 50%. That's totally unsustainable. So even China is having its own trouble, even though they're the financial beneficiaries of having all of this excess money that's being created by all the different nations in an attempt to inflate their way out of their debts. All that money is going into China, and it's not fun times for them either. So it's a bad time all the way around.
One of the things that really struck me as ironic, that was a fact that you had mentioned in one of your videos. You said that we bailed out the banks, and we had to borrow money to do this from them, and then we gave it back to them so they could lend it back to us at a high rate of interest. Were you saying that not only did we pay to print the money, or were you saying that we paid to print it and then we had to pay interest when we borrowed it?
All of the above. I mean, basically, right. A giant scam. We're selling bonds on the open market. Of course, the primary purchaser of those bonds are banks, both domestic and international. And then the biggest banks are then whining to Congress saying, now, if you don't give us this money that we just loaned you back in the form of a bailout, we're going to continue to crash your system. And we're buying it. Congress is buying it. You know, I say, let the banks fail. If every single bank in this country failed this afternoon, I guarantee you by 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, an entrepreneur would be on the street corner opening up a bank, because banks have vital services that we all need and want and are willing to pay for. There is no bank that's too big. Let them fail. Not one more governmental dollar to support a bank.
Well, don't you think that it's really ironic that Congress is thinking about taking all the safeguards off of the amount of money that the banks have to keep in reserve, especially after the huge bank failures that we just had?
Well, that was what President Obama said in a TV address, and it wasn't an address, it was a comment about 6 months ago. He said, I think we need to eliminate bank reserve requirements altogether. And typically, legally right now, according to international rules, banks are supposed to be held to 12 to 1. But as I said before, that's all banks are just ignoring that completely. We found out during the congressional investigation at the end of 2008 that all the big major banks in the United States were leveraged 50 and 52 to 1. Freddie and Fannie were leveraged 72 to 1. And Goldman Sachs was leveraged 333 to 1. So it's just a Wild West shootout up there. And it is absolutely for sure that, you know, the Ron Paul people, for example, say, oh, just let the market decide. Well, we've had the market deciding for at least the past decade. How's that worked out for us? Not very well. It's just totally indebted every nation on earth. Government has to play a role in this. We have to take back the money power away from these big banks, or we're just going to have an entire world run strictly for their pleasure and profit.
Doesn't it make you wonder, though, where are the bank regulators while all this is going on?
Well, they're completely bought off, and the honest ones are run out of town. Carl Denninger talks about this on his blog site all the time, how the last real honest one was completely run out of Washington.
Wow. Tell us what happened to the biggest bank in Iceland and how it got into trouble.
Well, it originally was the Icelandic central bank, Landsbanken, and they privatized it. Somehow the Icelanders bought into this privatization scheme, and then they took it abroad. It became a private bank, private commercial bank, and they started opening offices as the world financial real estate bubble blew up in the mid-2000s. And they started lending money to the British and the Dutch primarily. They had a bunch of bank branches there. Now, remember, this was a commercial bank now. It was not connected to the Icelandic government. And when the bubble blew up, the Icelandic banks were immediately stripped by the people at the top. They took out some $2 billion worth of loans to themselves. And now these guys are, of course, being sued in the state of New York for $2 billion. So the banks collapsed. And then the British and the Dutch said, oh, well, this is an Icelandic bank. The Icelandic government has to pay off our depositors. And, of course, Iceland was no more legally obligated to pay off the depositors of a private bank than you or I would be. But in the face of this horrible financial mess at in the fall of 2008, the IMF said, okay, well, we're not going to give Iceland any more loans, and we're going to cut them off from the food production of the continent, and the nation, being an island nation, doesn't have much food production, so you've only got 3 weeks of food on the island, and then your whole nation is going to face mass starvation, unless you agree to pay off the British and the Dutch depositors from this formerly Icelandic bank. And initially, the parliament gave in. I was in Iceland a year ago and talked to a parliamentarian and said, yeah, we were threatened with starvation. We only had 3 weeks of food. What did we do?
Well.
And but then the citizens just revolted, forced the president to veto that bill, and the president then put it to a referendum, which was voted down 92% to 8 by the Icelandic people. And so then it came to a vote again, a more moderate repayment proposal, a couple months ago, and they voted it down again, 60% to 40%. And the Wall Street Journal before the vote was saying, oh, if Iceland doesn't do this, they're never going to get credit on the international market and all this sort of nonsense. Well, the Icelandic people wisely ignored them once again and voted it down. And so now, just 2 months later, the IMF is encouraging Iceland to borrow money from them. Fitch, the ratings agency, has raised the Icelandic credit rating. So the bottom line is the Icelanders, in their wisdom, told the bondholders of the banks to stuff it. We're not going to bail you out. And they're doing just fine. And so that's exactly what Ireland should do, what every nation, all the entire Eurozone should do. They should get out of the Euro, get out of the European Union, and restructure their debts, issue their own money, and not take on any more debt.
Well, I think that we've seen this on a smaller scale. When somebody declares bankruptcy, usually a couple of years later they have great credit. So why shouldn't it be the same for a nation, you know?
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, when we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, it's to the benefit of these big bankers to try to convince the political class, the parliamentarians or the legislators that, no, don't do that, whatever you do, you know,
billions of dollars. I'm sorry. Who would you say today are the great bankers of the world? I know that I know that the Rothschilds are still in there somewhere.
Well, and I don't even, I don't talk about the Rothschilds or any of that stuff because I think that that just lays us open to criticism. It doesn't matter if you went and arrested every Rockefeller and every Rothschild in the world tomorrow, nothing would change. The system is way bigger than any individual at this point, and it's just a rabbit trail that opens us up to criticism and diverts us from what the real solution is. It's not who they are, it's what they are doing. Mm. And it's what we can easily do to break the back of this bank enslavement. As long as we are diverted by all these rabbit trails, when the truth is right in front of us and so easy to fix, just eliminate the ability of our government to borrow, pay off the existing debt with new U.S. notes, which would replace Federal Reserve notes on a one-for-one basis. As the Treasury bonds come due, pay them off with the new U.S. notes. If the bondholders don't like that form of money, then fine, they just tell them they aren't going to get paid. And, of course, they'll all accept the new money. And then forbid the government from issuing any more bonds. No more bonds, and take away the ability of fractional reserve lending from the banks, and everything would be hunky-dory, and our nation would immediately get out of debt, be put on a firm financial standing, and the only thing we have to do to make this work, and this is what the gold bugs will complain, oh, if you give those rascals in Congress the ability to create money, they're going to print too much and we're going to have hyperinflation. Well, yeah, that's possible, but what you do is you have Congress set the inflation target, and in other words, the target would be just as much as the increase in population, 2 to 3% per year, so that basically you have the same amount of money per capita in the hands every year after year. And then you have an independent organization like a monetary Congress. I don't care how you do it, but I would say basically elect it from the states so that each state has an input into the monetary scheme. And then these guys, this monetary Congress, would determine how much money is actually created. So the bottom line is all you have to do is control the quantity, and then everything is just fine. Now, if that's all you have to do, just get some honest people to look at the inflation numbers and control the quantity of money who aren't part of the U.S. Congress. Is that really too much to ask in order to get us out of this horrible situation? I don't think so.
Do you believe that the New World Order is tied in with the big banks?
Well, the New World Order is just this march towards a consolidation of power at every level of governance, the financial, the political, and even the religious. And that's why I say that all of this consolidation of power should be opposed, and we should understand where this is going and what we're supposed to do. We have to oppose the consolidation of power at every level of government, and that is what people mean when they talk about the New World Order, I believe.
There's talk of memos that existed that showed that the Great Depression in this country was caused by banks trying to take land away from people. Would you tell us what you know about that?
Well, it's even more cast in stone than that. When, on the occasion of Milton Friedman's 90th birthday, a bunch of people threw him a big birthday party, and Ben Bernanke, head of the Fed, got up and made some remarks, and he apologized to Milton Friedman because Friedman and his writing partner, Anna Schwartz, I believe, had written a paper many years ago running the numbers and showing that the Great Depression was caused by the Federal Reserve, which at that time, remember, was only 20 years old and had been brought into power specifically to prevent these tremendous vacillations in the economy. Anyway, Friedman had showed that it was the Fed that caused the depression by reducing the overall money supply in the country by 33% and then refusing to print more money, to push more money into the system, and that's what perpetuated, that's what created the length of the Great Depression. Well, Bernanke got up and said and apologized to Friedman and said, "You're right, we did do that, but now we're smarter and wiser, and we will never do that again." So there's now no further question that it was the Fed that caused the Great Depression. So that's a case closed.
Well, we know what bankers get out of causing depressions, but do they get anything out of causing inflation?
Well, yeah, I mean, because they're the ones lending the money. They're the ones on the upside of the bubble. They're lending all this money, getting all this good interest. I remember, I believe it was the head of Citigroup during the 2008 congressional hearings on the big collapse. The way he put it was, when the music's playing, you got to get up and dance. In other words, all these banks were lending money they didn't have and ignoring reserve requirements and just lending more and more and playing the derivatives market and all that. And he was basically saying, I had to do it because if I didn't do it, my profits wouldn't be as big as the other banks and I'd lose my job. So, because our stock would go down. So it's kind of a system that drives itself on the upside. And then when they decide that they've had about enough upside and they start to contract the money supply and it goes on the downside, then of course they have they win going down as well, because they get to foreclose and as Carl Denninger puts it, assets strip the assets of the American people.
Have you ever had people try to discredit you and then find out that they were under the employ of banks or connected with banks in any way?
No, it's never happened. And my theory is that I'm just too small. I'm just a little pimple out here in the big bad world. And I have an international following, but it's still small comparison to anybody on TV, for example. So I'm not really a threat to them, and for them to come after me in any way, they're smart enough to know, would just draw attention to me and make me stronger.
Now, there have been allegations that when the Shah of Iran was given the same type of printing press that our money is printed on, he was also given plates to print money. Now, did you ever hear this? that he was able to print U.S. money and he could print as much as he wanted, we wouldn't interfere with him?
No, that's news to me. However, I do know that during the time of FDR, through the Lend-Lease, well, actually, this was the last part of FDR, yeah, and the first part of Truman, with Lend-Lease, there were printing plates for U.S. money sent through the Lend-Lease program over to the Soviet Union, and the Soviets were counterfeiting American money. But I'd never heard about the Shah of Iran.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't mean he was counterfeiting it. I mean they gave him actual government plates. G. Edward Griffin made
But that's just the big banks all the time. So, uh-huh. I mean, that's what they do. They counterfeit our money. They just do it electronically. And 95% of our money is electronic money anyway.
Right, right. G. Edward Griffin made a statement when he criticized some of your videos. One thing that he had said seemed very much in error to me. He was talking about gold and silver-backed currency, and he said that gold and silver cannot be manipulated by bankers or free-spending politicians, but fiat money can be and always will be. Now, I say the value of diamonds has been controlled for 100 years, so why can't gold? Do you agree with that?
Well, absolutely, and that's exactly why I wrote The Secret of Oz and produced it as a video, exactly why I wrote the book version, No More National Debt. It's to show in our monetary history that just the reverse is true. It's gold money has never worked to enhance freedom of the middle class at any place in world history at any time. Every time that America has gone on to a gold money system, it's created a vast depression. Why? Because gold is bankers' money. It's expensive money. It's very easy for bankers to manipulate the quantity of. And don't tell me that, you know, the gold bugs are on our side in one way. They know that the quantity of money has to be controlled. They're just under this misapprehension that gold's going to do it. And when you look at our monetary history, that has not been the case. If the President of the United States called you up tomorrow, for example, and said, hey, I've got this inside tip. I want you to be the first to know. Tomorrow I'm going to decree a return to gold-backed money by executive order, and I'm not going to tell anybody else but you, what would you do? You would immediately go out and buy as much gold as you could get your hands on. You'd mortgage your house, you'd take out loans, whatever you could to buy as much gold as you could, because the next day you know gold was gonna jump up by a factor of 100. So that, what do you think the rich guys of the world would do, you know, as a gold money bill slogged its way through Congress? You'd see gold futures go through the roof. Now, in order for money to effectively serve the public interest, it has to be valueless. Why? Because especially in these days of electronic trading, if you have any basis of money that's a commodity that's traded electronically, it's going to be manipulated electronically. The only way that money can serve the public interest for it to be valueless.
The attack on the middle class is never ending. Do you think that the rich and powerful are trying to create a low-paid workforce that will work 6 or 7 days a week and maybe 12 hours a day?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what's behind it. And Gouverneur Morris, really the father of the Constitution, wrote a massive percentage of the Constitution, has this great quote, which I quote in the book and in the video, which is really the essence of how, because I'm not for doing away with rich people. I'm not doing away for rightly constructed capitalism. I'm just for doing away with what we have today, which goes for capitalism, which is basically just monopoly capitalism. It's also called financial capitalism. That's bad. But Gouverneur Morris had exactly the right take on it and said that the rich will always try to do that, will always try to push the middle class down for their own benefit, and they always will. And unless we, by our combined power of government, keep them in their proper spheres. So in other words, the rich should not be able to completely control the government, the political situation as well. And that's the situation we have today, where the big banks and bank money has just gotten to be so huge that they're getting anything out of Congress that they want, and we've got to take that power back.
Well, you did a lot of material on health. How did you ever get interested in the economy?
Well, back I ran a newspaper here in Northern Virginia for a number of years, and an old guy called me up in about 1980, and it sounded kind of crazy. He goes, "Boy, have I got a story for you. There's no gold left in Fort Knox." And I just kind of rolled my eyes, and I developed a standard answer for crazy people calling, which was, "Oh, that's great. Send me something in the mail." Got me off the phone in about 30 seconds, and the crazy people never had anything to send, and so I never heard from them again. But a couple days later, this guy was not crazy. He sent me a huge sheaf of papers. His name was Ed Durrell. He was a retired Ohio farm implement manufacturer, and he'd come to Washington to pursue his hobby, which is to try to get the federal government to prove that there was any gold at all left in Fort Knox. And so I wrote a story about it, and it was well received, but I just couldn't put the pieces together very well. What did gold in Fort Knox have to do with it? And it took me about 10 or 12 years, and I finally figured it out, wrote a book about it, and then some people read the book and wanted to finance the Money Masters video, and so that's how all that got started.
Mm. Do you think there's any connection between the gold disappearing in Fort Knox and the gold disappearing on 9/11?
I have no idea. I haven't investigated that whole 9/11 thing, so I can't respond to that.
Okay. In 2009, in your report entitled SR8, you stated that politicians probably don't understand what the national debt is. Do you still believe that today, or do you think that they're just plain corrupt?
No, I think the whole purpose of the banking class at this point is to keep people confused. That's why they love people like Ron Paul who say, "Yeah, we need to get in there and audit the Fed and end the Fed." Ending the Fed would do absolutely nothing. Nothing. So I think the whole purpose is to just keep these politicians confused. They make too many stupid statements. I don't think they'd be doing that by design. I think it just shows their confusion about how money is created.
Do you think that the European Union was formed by bankers, and why or why not do you feel this way?
Well, yeah, because it's just the ultimate consolidation of power of the European financial power. They're attempting these giant financial consolidation schemes and political consolidation schemes, and they've never worked in the past. I mean, the League of Nations back in the early 1900s was a dismal failure. The United Nations has been a dismal failure and is completely disrespected and is absolutely the opposite of what it's supposed to be, namely to support democratically elected governance, and instead it's run by the tyrants of the world. So it's going nowhere. The European Union now, increasingly, just within the last year, I mean, you would never hear basic complaints by academics about the structure of the EU, and now it's all over everywhere. Everybody's saying it's basically flawed and it's going to eventually come apart, et cetera, et cetera. So these consolidation of power schemes, especially when they cross national lines, I mean, you basically, people love the sovereignty of their individual nation. I'm all for national sovereignty, for French national sovereignty, for European or for English national sovereignty, for Chinese national sovereignty, for goodness sakes. It's that independent power of the nation state grinding against keeps the world relatively free. And that was the basis of the U.S. Constitution, though it's never mentioned in the Constitution, this term, the separation of powers concept, where you have a lot of competing powers always fighting amongst each other That makes effective government very slow, very ponderous, very difficult to actually do anything, but very, very safe. Safe from being taken over by dictatorship. Dictatorship, the ultimate consolidators of power. This consolidation of power should always, we should focus on like a laser beam, that, you know, that should be our North Star, our guiding principle.
Are you familiar with the fact that the Finance Committee of the European Union suggested to Ireland that they should not hold elections until they paid their debt off?
No, that's a new one on me. It doesn't surprise me, but I, you know, that's Ireland right now is the front lines of this battle, and if not Greece, but I think Greece is just in too deep trouble at this point to really mount an effective resistance. But Ireland and Iceland, to me, are the front lines of this battle where we can most effectively put our energies to try to defeat them. If Ireland now, following the Iceland example, stiffs the IMF, stiffs the bankers, you know, then other nations are going to look and they're going to say, oh, well, let's see, Iceland's okay, and if Ireland does it, and then Ireland's okay, well, maybe we can get away with it too. So this is really a very exciting time. I never thought in my lifetime I'd actually be able to witness this revolt going on.
Well, I just thought, I mean, It goes totally against democracy when the European Union says something like that, you know. What is a public interest bank, and why do you think it's good?
Well, like I said before, money should serve the public interest. That's what people think is going on intuitively. However, that's not what's going on. So any type of a bank that's constituted either at the state level, at the municipal level, or at the federal level, a bank that's constituted which actually serves the public interest, you know, I'm going to be in favor of it. Because money should serve the public interest. That's what you have with the example of the Bank of North Dakota. It's been an operation for nearly 100 years, so this is not some new startup. That's why North Dakota has the lowest unemployment rate, among the lowest estate taxes, because the bank plows back in over the past decade over $1/3 of $1 billion into the state treasury because it's using state money to serve the state's interest instead of having the state go out whenever it wants to build a road, for example. It floats a bond issue. Well, now, what does that mean? That means it goes to the big New York money center banks and says, will you loan our state money? And, you know, these big bond issues that stretch over 20 or 30 years, it's just like your house mortgage. It doubles or triples the cost. The big bankers don't care because, they're in it for the long-term gain anyway, but just further and further indebts these states, and this is entirely unnecessary, just as it's entirely unnecessary on the national level. We don't have to have a national debt. States don't have to float bond issues. They can all have their individual state banks and self-finance any bond issue they need at 0% interest.
I read something about the Bank of North Dakota, but I'm sure you know a lot more about it than I do. And it was a criticism. It said they were light on lending mortgage money. What do you think about that?
Light on lending mortgage? Well, a state bank shouldn't be involved in lending mortgage money. You know, there's a gubernatorial candidate in Florida, for example, in the last cycle, and that was his big thing, that he wanted a state bank in Florida, and he wanted the state bank to take over all mortgage lending. Well, see, this goes against my basic principle, and that is deconsolidation of power. I don't agree with that at all. I don't think government should take over the banking function. We need commercial banks. We need commercial banks competing. We need that power spread out amongst all these different financial money centers. We don't need it. We don't need, especially, all the money power consolidated into government. I mean, this is the ultimate communist dream, to have a state central bank with all the lending power, you know, issuing all the credit to it.
I want to ask you if this surprises you. A report by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston was released in May of this year. It discouraged other states, especially Massachusetts, from forming one of these public interest banks. They specifically spoke about the Bank of North Dakota. The report stated that Massachusetts doesn't need this type of bank because they have plenty of other large banks that can lend money.
Right. Well, once again, all they're saying is, oh, no, don't let the state discover that it doesn't have to borrow money from us. You know, once national governments don't have to borrow. They can have the banking power and put it to the public interest. Now, that's not saying that they take over all commercial lending. That's not saying they lend out a single mortgage to a private individual. No, that should be the purview of the commercial competitive banking industry. But when it comes to the state business, to the public interest, then yes, a state should have its own bank. A sovereign nation should have its own bank so that it does not have to borrow from commercial banks. You cannot have the political entity borrowing from the commercial entity, because then the commercial entity always ends up controlling the political entity, and that's not what we want.
Now, tell my readers about your new book and where they can find it.
Well, it's called No More National Debt, and it's the first printed book to have QR codes, quick response codes, which you can scan with your cell phone, and it'll take you out to supplemental information that any place that I tell it to go on the internet. So I usually it points you to YouTube videos and stuff like that. And it can be found on my website, which is www.billstill.com.
Is there anything that I haven't covered, Bill, that you'd like to talk about?
No, I mean, I think we've really gotten to the basics of it, and that's I'm always going to be for deconsolidation of power. I'm never going to be for a nation or a state to take over the commercial banking industry. I think that would be a horrible idea, but I will never be for a nation or a state or any political entity borrowing from a commercial bank. Nations and states can create. They do not have to borrow.
Okay, I want to thank you, Bill. That was really a very interesting interview.